Well, it's not the first or the last time I bailed on the Tiger game when things looked good and ended up regretting it. We went to bed halfway through the seventh inning, I believe, probably like a few of you, and lived to regret it. And of all the people, David Ortiz. My foremost memory of Ortiz was of striking out a couple of times. I want to say he struck out twice leading up to his Grand Slam, and he returns to put Boston back in the game. And just a terrific performance by Max Scherzer, all for naught, unfortunately. Game three tomorrow, Justin Verlander for the Tigers, John Lackey for the Red Sox as we pursue another American League pennant. Coming up on Current State, MLive columnist Susan J. Demas will become the new owner of Inside Michigan Politics newsletter. Susan joins us in just a little bit. We'll talk about Tigers playoff history in just a little bit, too, with author John Rosenberg. But first, homecoming weekend here at MSU brought thousands of students and East Lansing residents together in a spirit of camaraderie. City officials are hoping to extend that sense of civic pride. This week, they're asking citizens to look at the bigger picture. That's the name of East Lansing's long-range comprehensive plan. The city will study its land usage to come up with the best strategies for residential and retail development. And joining us now to talk about the bigger picture, Tim Dempsey, the Director of Planning, Building, and Development for the City of East Lansing. Good to have you back, Tim.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Explain what happens this week, then, as you encourage public participation in the bigger picture.
Absolutely. What we're trying to do this week is really spend a lot of time with residents, and that's everybody. That's our permanent residents, that's students, the entire East Lansing community, to get input on the vision for the future of our community. And we're doing it a little bit different this time. We're trying to pack a lot into one week. So this is the week to really come out and give input and feedback. There's always opportunities in the future, but we're really trying to get some critical mass going in terms of getting people out and talking about the issues, thinking about the issues, and then visioning what they want to see this community to be.
And looking at more than just the project that's right in front of our faces, the projects that are right in front of us right now, and trying to look long-term. Is that part of this?
That is definitely part of it. We'd like to have those opportunities where we can think about the entire development aspect of our community rather than just focusing on a project, because sometimes we get caught up in the heat of the moment of a particular project. It's important for people to step back and really think about how all of these projects interact and what it means for the future in terms of, will they work together well, will they not, and how can we design them and develop them in the way that they really benefit the entire community.
Now, I have to ask, are you going into this this session here this week with a pretty good idea of what you'll hear, or are you surprised sometimes at what citizens bring up?
Really, it's both. There's a lot of times when we hear kind of the same old things from people, a lot of it which is really good. People like a walkable community. They like a green community. They want to see mixed-use development. But sometimes we're surprised, I think. And the surprises are some of the best ideas, we think, in terms of trying to think differently about problems, especially with trying to come up with maybe a creative solution or two that could really prod us to think about something in a different way.
Well, let's spend a minute or two just on the short term. I understand the focus on the bigger picture is the longer term, but the Park District project, which is related to the former City Center 2 project, has a long history of fits and starts, but it has been in the news an awful lot lately with DTN Management's proposal, and I understand this is a longer, protracted process. How confident are you that the DTN plan or something very much like it will become reality?
We feel really good about the DTN process right now. In fact, that's part of the work we're doing this week. Wednesday night at the Broad Art Museum at 5:30, we'll be having our second charrette for that project. But I think DTN has developed with their consultants a really solid plan to go forward with these three different charrettes, which are kind of design-focused events to give us an opportunity to hear from the public specifically on this project and what they want to see in it. And I think with DTN's track record of projects and their financial capacity, we feel really good about moving forward.
And what happens tonight? I know you get started tonight.
Yeah, tonight is a kickoff event at the Hanna Community Center starting at 5. But we're going to have Lou Glazer from Michigan Future talk. And Lou talks a lot about talent in the state of Michigan and what it means for our future in terms of economic prosperity. Because when you talk about planning and development, that only comes with jobs and economic development and being able to have a strong economy. And Lou talks about that connection of talent, particularly young talent, graduates from MSU, for example, mm-hmm. and how they play a key role in that.
We're talking with the City of East Lansing's Planning and Development Director, Tim Dempsey. What do you make of the response so far to DTN's plan?
You know, so far, I think we've had very positive response. The people that have participated in the first charrette gave us a lot of good ideas, but I think everybody has been very happy and satisfied with the way that they've reached out to the public and incorporated the concerns of the community.
Yeah. Is there one aspect of the project? Is there a concern or a potential hurdle in the DTN project that rises to the top for you?
You know, the big concern with any project is always going to be financing, making sure that the project, as you know, will ultimately be proposed, can be financially funded. So you really have to think through that well and be conservative in how we look at that, and the city will do that. But that's always going to be really in the back of our heads a critical issue. But I think if we take it step by step and work closely with DTN, I think we can get over any of those potential hurdles.
Is Scott Chappell involved in this at all? I mean, he is involved in this because he still owns a big chunk of the downtown space. What is that company's role in the future here?
Probably limited to nothing, because right now DTN has options on that property. So if we're able to move forward with the project, it's our expectation that DTN will take ownership of those properties and that Strathmore will no longer be a participant.
It's ironic you should be here today, because the Lansing State Journal has also put developer Kevin McGraw's proposal for the Trowbridge Plaza right on its front page today. This would put a new exterior on the shopping center and replace three buildings, the Wendy's restaurant, the Oodles of Noodles, and the old drive-through bank building. Give us your take on this plan.
There's something that goes back a few years when the City of East Lansing worked with Michigan State University in a couple landscape architecture and urban planning classes to design some ideas and do some visioning with that community. We recognize that that corridor is an important entrance to our community, and now with the Amtrak station being redeveloped, we think there's a great opportunity to maybe do some ancillary development nearby that will benefit that area. So we're definitely interested in seeing what Mr. McGraw is going to bring forward. I mean, we've had some conversations about it, but we also know that he's working closely with the neighborhood groups in terms of their potential desires as well as concerns for the project.
Now, more housing is also a part of Kevin McGraw's tentative plan from Caddis Development. We have seen something of a mini housing boom here in the community recently. Is too much housing becoming a concern for you, Tim?
You know, that's certainly a question that we're continuing to ask ourselves. What is the right amount of student housing? And I think when you look at the housing that's been developed in East Lansing recently, we've tended towards the smaller to medium-sized projects. We're certainly concerned about some of maybe the really large projects, particularly projects that aren't within walking distance or biking distance to campus. Because from our perspective, if students are living closer to campus, they're less likely to be in their vehicles, more likely to be on bike or foot, and that's better, you know, way for them to get around. It's also alleviating some of the traffic concerns that we face in our community.
At the same time, you've got a good deal of expansion in the northern reaches of the city on and around Chandler Road. Some of that development is student housing. But does that concern you then, that students are moving further from campus and then are less connected to the economic core?
Yeah, that's absolutely a concern. And when you look at most of the housing in the northern tier, it's actually in Bath Township. And a lot of the housing that is in East Lansing came into our city after the fact. There is some additional development going on up there right now, and again, that is in Bath Township as well. So we are concerned about that. Certainly, we think that it makes a lot of sense, again, to have students closer to campus. At the same time, we know that the marketplace, you know, drives development in a lot of ways, and certainly that's what's happening up there right now. But something for us to keep an eye on.
How do you keep from getting too focused on the short term as opposed to the long term? You're asking residents to take a long term view. How do you keep yourself from getting too focused on the short term?
No, that's a real challenge. And I think a week like this week, our planning week, is a good way to do that, when we can actually set some time aside, quite a bit of time with our residents, to be engaged in those conversations. I think as a staff, because we'll be closely involved in this process, that's one way that we do it.
The silence is deafening with regard to the Red Cedar project. Can you shed any light on where that's at right now and when we might learn more about what's happening with the Red Cedar project?
You know, that's one project actually I can't provide much insight on. That, you know, it's certainly a question for our counterparts in the city of Lansing.
They have been trying to learn more and to no avail recently. Now, the last time that we had the equivalent of this bigger picture was back in 2006. I guess the city is required by law to undergo a comprehensive planning process. What happened in 2006, and how much have East Lansing's needs changed since 2006?
In 2006, we actually did a full update of our comprehensive plan. It was the first one since the early 1980s. And what we recognize this time around is because the economy has changed so significantly, given what happened in 2008 and into 2009, that we needed to really do more of just the typical five-year update. That's why we're doing a lot more public participation than we might do on a regular update, realizing that, yes, the economy has changed and we need to maybe rethink some of our priorities, particularly as they relate to, you know, redevelopment.
What about all the activity in Lansing Township? How does that impact you? That creates a density concerns as well, I imagine.
You know, I think the development up in Eastwood is something that certainly impacted our downtown initially. I think the ongoing development has maybe less of an impact as, you know, the market has kind of matured and each area has kind of identified its niche. You know, fortunately, we've been able to continue to have some redevelopment projects and added some new restaurants to stay competitive. But certainly as you have development throughout the marketplace, you can look at it one of two ways. You can take the pessimistic view that it's just competition, or kind of the more optimistic view, which is, hey, rising tide lifts all ships, and the more development we have, the more opportunities to go out to eat, the more opportunities for places to live, makes our region more attractive. And that's the viewpoint that I prefer to take, is that, you know, we're really trying to improve the Lansing region. East Lansing is one component of that.
What do you make of the transformation of Ann Grove and Albert there, the Ann Street Plaza? That has changed dramatically.
I think that's a great example of the potential of redevelopment in our downtown. If you were down there at all this weekend, for instance, the level of activity was great. You had the patios were filled, the restaurants were filled, our plaza had lots of activity. People were sitting out, people were walking around. It was really what you want. You have a great public space with these private uses that mix well, and it creates a level of activity and excitement that people want to see in a nice downtown.
As a college town, East Lansing sometimes has a challenging relationship with students. Often residents will focus on any number of negatives, loud parties, occasional violence, but from a planning perspective, how does the city take this transient population who aren't here necessarily for that long and try to make them into stakeholders?
Yeah, that's a real challenge. We try a number of things. We try to incorporate them into some of our boards and commissions. But then on a planning week like this, like we'll have an open house on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at Scene Metro Space from noon to 7. Students can come by at any point, just kind of stop in, give us their ideas, trying to move away maybe from the formal meeting setting to a more casual kind of conversation-based. And trying to think of things like that, they're a little bit creative, to get students engaged where otherwise they might say, you know what, I don't want to go to the typical kind of city government-type meeting, but I'd be happy to stop into this art gallery and talk about design or just give them my ideas about what I think makes a cool city.
If you could change one thing about the city, be it a commercial zone, be it its residential areas, what would you like to see in East Lansing?
You know, I think one of the things that we struggle with in East Lansing, we often get compared to Madison, Ann Arbor. And if you look at those downtowns, I would argue that they have kind of two downtowns. Ann Arbor, for instance, most people are familiar with. You have Main Street, which has a lot of the higher-end restaurants, and then you have State Street, which has more of the student-oriented downtowns. And because of that, they've been able to accomplish a little bit more in terms of nicer restaurants. We'd like to see more of that ourselves, but we have to do it in a single downtown. So for us, it's a little bit more of a challenge that way. I think we're up to that challenge and we're making progress, but certainly trying to have uses that attract that broader demographic, that, you know, the empty nesters, the people that maybe might otherwise shy away because they feel, hey, there's too many students here.
What's it like having Jackson National in the old bookstore space?
I think it's fabulous. I think to have Jackson make a major investment in our downtown, again, they're doing it. If you look why, go back to the Lou Glaser discussion that we'll hear tonight, it's about talent. They want to be near Michigan State University because they want to take advantage of all of that great young talent.
They're happy there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that you know, we'll be very happy long term. Hopefully they will be as well. But I think to have them in our downtown is great to have that corporate presence.
It's a big job that the city of East Lansing wants as many eyes and as much participation on the process as possible. It's called the Bigger Picture, and it gets started tonight at the Hanna Community Center, and it lasts all this week. I'm sure you can find out more at the City of East Lansing website.
That's right, cityofeastlansing.com, and just look at comprehensive plan, and the week schedule is there, and we invite everybody and anybody that wants to participate.
Tim Dempsey is the Director of Planning, Building, and Development for East Lansing. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Well, Detroit Tiger fans are once again wrapped up in the drama of October madness as the Tigers pursue another American League pennant against the Red Sox. Author John Rosenberg talks with WKAR's Peter Wharf right now about how past and recent Detroit Tiger baseball teams have provided inspiration and unity for the Motor City during trying times.
So in 1934, Hank Greenberg and the Detroit Tigers unseated the mighty New York Yankees of Lou Gehrig, Babe Ruth, Tony Lazzari, Lefty Gomez. And they provided the Detroit public with a lot of excitement, and at a time when it was very, the city was in a mood of despair. I mean, the Depression had hit the city hard. Auto production from 1929 to 1931 had fallen 75%. Unemployment by 1935 was almost 50%, about 46%. And so the city was bankrupt, paying its employees in scrip. And so there was this mood of despair in the city, except at Navin Field, Greenberg and Goose Goslin and Mickey Cochran and Charlie Gehringer and the rest of the Tigers were challenging the Yankees for the pennant and providing a sense of hope and civic pride. And they prevailed and won the pennant, the first pennant that Detroit had had since 1909. There had been this 25-year drought in the city, and so Detroit fans were excited to have that pennant and feel this mood of victory, and you know, we're number one on top again. They lost in the World Series to the Cardinals.
Right.
And then in the next year, 35, Greenberg's the MVP of the American League, and they win the pennant once again, and Detroit becomes the city of champions with not only the Tiger success, but the Red Wings and also the Lions winning the titles. And so here Detroit is feeling, you know, wonderful, and the Tigers go on to win the World Series, and the mood in Detroit for that small sliver of time, those 2 years, they were able to forget the soup lines and the you know, the unemployment and the difficulties, and have a good feeling at least for that segment.
Up comes Goose Goslin. It's a base hit. And now watch Mickey fly around those sacks. He rounds third. He's coming home. And here comes Mickey Cochran with the winning run. The run that won the game and the World Series for the Detroit Tigers.
That notion, City of Champions, I hadn't realized that the Tigers won World Series, NFL championship, and the Stanley Cup in 35 all at once.
Right, and so that, hence the name, the City of Champions, and they had a banquet to honor the three teams, and you can imagine the civic pride that people were feeling during that time, and especially when, you know, the auto industry was so hard hit by the Depression, and what sports do best, I think, is bring a community together and help people feel good about themselves, and that's what those teams were doing, led by the Tigers, during a time when it truly was the national pastime, America's game.
We think of 29 as the stock market crash, and then the 30s are the years where things are really going downhill. But they went downhill for a long time. I mean, 34, 35, this is what people think of as sort of the heart, the deepest part of the Depression.
Yeah, America really didn't come out of the Depression or Detroit until they could became the arsenal of democracy when they converted from auto production to making arms and for the war. And that happened in the 30s, first when they were supplying Europe with Britain with their machinery, and then the United States with their own machinery as the U.S. entered the war in 41. But the beginning, that 34-35 spell was the beginning of this trend when the Tigers helped Detroit feel better about themselves during tough times, or when the Tigers came through during tough times for Detroit, because you had 34-35, they won the pennant those years. 40, they won the pennant, just as things were looking nasty in Europe. But then 45, they won the World Series right after the war, and as America's converting back to peacetime. And so here the Tigers help America feel good as they're healing from the war. And then they come through again in 68, following the riots in Detroit, and bring the community together.
And the windup and the pitch. He swings, a line shot, base hit, right field, the Tigers win it. Here comes K-Line to score, and it's all over. Don Wirt singles, the Tigers mob Don. K-Line has scored, the fans are steaming on the field, and the Tigers have won their first pennant since 1945. Let's listen to the bedlam here at Tiger Stadium.
And then now, look at what they're doing now with the city again bankrupt and, population having decreased and so many of the city having been gutted by the diaspora from downtown. And here the Tigers, about to clinch the pennant and, you know, hopefully go deep in the playoffs.
As a kid who grew up in Michigan and is a lifelong Tigers fan, I love this idea that you're expressing of the Detroit Tigers always being there during times that the people really need them.
Yeah, and that's what they did back in 34-35, and I think they're doing it again. I mean, I was at the ballpark last Sunday when they played the White Sox, and even though they lost the game, I mean, the stadium was packed, and the people were still glowing from the night before when they came back from a six-run deficit in the bottom of the ninth, tied it, and then went on to win in extra innings. So there was really the mood in the stadium was one of hope and just on the edge of joy. I think that they're waiting to feel the absolute joy till they clinch the pennant and then hopefully win the World Series. But there is that good feeling that the Tigers are bringing back to Detroit.
John Rosengren is the author of the 2013 book, Hank Greenberg, Hero of Heroes. John, thanks again for talking to us about some of the great Detroit Tigers teams of the 1930s and 40s and more. John, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Will our ball club win the pennant? Do you think they have a chance? And tell me, friend, how in the world have you been? Tell me what's on right. I want to know what's in. What's the deal, man? What's happening? What's happening, brother? What's happening?
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A big thank you again for helping WKAR with our fall membership campaign last week. We have many of you to thank. You called in pledges totaling more than $113,000. Thanks also to all of our underwriters and volunteers who helped us out in 2013. Your support continues to make possible all the quality news and music programming that you depend on here from WKAR. Again, a big thank you to all of us from us here at 90.5 WKAR. There's been a change at the top of an established Michigan political publication since he founded it in 1987. Bill Ballinger's been the publisher and editor of Inside Michigan Politics. During those 26 years, the former Republican state rep and senator has become an often questioned, often quoted political journalist. Last week, Ballinger announced that he is selling the publication to Susan Demas, a veteran reporter and MLive columnist, and here to talk about her new role, Susan J. Demas of Inside Michigan Politics. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you in here. Congratulations, first of all.
Thanks.
Has it been a career goal of yours to own and manage something in this way?
Absolutely. And given the changing face of media, it seemed like an elusive goal for a while. But I'm very fortunate, and I really appreciate the opportunity that I get to work with Bill Ballinger for the next 3 years as well.
He's staying on as associate editor?
Yes.
Is that his title? Okay.
He'll be writing for the newsletter, as I will, and our stable of freelance reporters. But, you know, getting to work up close and personal with Bill Ballinger sounds like a lot of fun to me.
You get to worry about how much to charge, though, and circulation and all of that fun stuff that you may... Have you been in an administrative position like this before at any of your gigs?
I have
gigs?
Been. Okay. I've been an editor. I've been in charge of freelance budgets. I have my own freelance business, so I had to pay my own bills and my own taxes. My father is an accountant, so I have a wealth of information to draw from.
That doesn't hurt, I suppose. I'm curious how long you've been a reader of the publication you're about to take over.
Well, I moved to Michigan 9 years ago, and literally within the first week I was here, I heard of Inside Michigan Politics, and I was calling Bill Ballinger for a story. I was a reporter for the Livingston County paper out there. But, you know, I asked the vice president of the company who was involved in the editorial, well, who do I talk to about politics around here? And he said, Bill Ballinger. And so he has been a source and later on a friend.
And for our listeners who are less familiar with the publication itself, what is Inside Michigan Politics all about? What do readers get?
Well, our publication comes out twice a month. You get news and analysis. So you kind of get what's going on behind the scenes in Lansing and in the state, not just, you know, what you might get off a press release, talking points, but, you know, the inside scoop, because, you know, Bill Ballinger knows what's going on. He's run for office. He's served. He's been in administrations. He knows the ins and outs. And I think that's what our readers have come to expect.
Are you satisfied with your circulation right now and your readership, or do you have a plan to beef it up, or what?
I am satisfied with it, but I think there's always room to grow, and, you know, that's something Bill and I talked about extensively, that he thought one of the reasons to pass it along was so that somebody else could further grow this business. I'm very excited about the possibility, because I think that it's a pretty reasonable publication, and I think that it could be of use to an awful lot of people.
It's been generally a lot more challenging environment for print journalism. What role does Inside Michigan Politics play there? Do you see more upside to online, for example, as opposed to the print publication?
Well, we offer both, and actually more of our readers still like it in print form. But there's so much there are so many possibilities online and with social media. So I think you're going to see that Inside Michigan Politics will keep its core newsletter, what people count on, but there are lots of new avenues we can go in as well.
Now, Bill was a Republican state lawmaker who has a generally hospitable view of the GOP and the Snyder administration, and the views in your MLive columns are anything but fairly regularly. Is the newsletter's op-ed profile going to be changing?
No. I mean, our MO is nonpartisan, unbiased analysis, and that's what it's going to stay, no matter, you know, who is at the helm. That's what Inside Michigan Politics is all about. Bill and I appear regularly and off the record. We often agree on things. He's my favorite person to appear with. And, you know, with those MLive columns, what a lot of people seem to forget is how unpopular I was with the columns that I wrote about Governor Jennifer Granholm, who was a Democrat. But that was many years ago, and I understand that people have short memories.
What do you make of all the vitriol that gets generated online especially. I mean, I'm a fairly regular reader of your column, but Tim's and Matt Davis's as well. There's more vitriol online that gets shared than ever before. How do you process all
that? That's true. You know, honestly, I'm just glad that people are reading. And, you know, I don't take it personally. People are going to be angry. People are going to have a reaction. And at the end of the day, if people still find me worth reading, that's an honor.
But is it a good thing? Is all of this partisan vitriol a good thing?
I don't think so. And okay. I don't think Bill Ballinger thinks so either. When he was serving, I don't think there was as much of it, you know, back in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that's our landscape today. And I think it's up to, you know, reasonable people to try and have reasonable discourse, and we can reasonably disagree. And of course, there will be some people who still want to be vitriolic, and that's unfortunate.
That is the main part of the meal, it seems, for more and more people, is just that partisan divide, and it's really what people, more than the issues.
Yeah.
It's just, is it right? Is it left? If it's right, I agree. If it's left, I disagree. Whatever.
It's kind of like being a Tigers fan. You're either with them or against them. And politics is a little more complicated than that.
You've mentioned to me that it's significant that Inside Michigan Politics now becomes one of the few political publications to be managed by a woman. What's the significance of that in your mind? Why is that important?
Well, in general, there are so few women who own publications or are publishers or even executive editors. That's still a glass ceiling. And so I feel honored that I'm one of the few women in the state to have such a position. And I, you know, fully intend to do my best to support other women in journalism in my role, because I think it's important for more women to enter the profession and to rise up in its ranks as well.
But do you expect your content to reflect that?
You know, I think at the end of the day, Inside Michigan Politics is going to stay the same in its core mission. But, you know, having a woman, you know, I'm conscious of the fact that there are only 4 women out of 38 senators. That's something that I happen to notice every day as I cover the Capitol. You know, maybe a man wouldn't be as conscious of that. And that's an interesting story in and of itself, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Would you expect maybe to pick up more women readers after you're at the helm?
I certainly hope so. I hear the stereotype all the time that women aren't as interested in politics, and I just frankly don't believe that.
Tell us a little bit about your background. I know you spent some time at the Detroit News. You've been at various places. Tell us about that.
Well, I've been a journalist for 12 years. I started out at the Cedar Rapids Gazette in Iowa, and I moved to Michigan 9 years ago. I've worked for various papers, including the Battle Creek Inquirer, Saginaw News, and I've written columns for various publications, including the Detroit News, Lansing State Journal, MLive, Real Clear Politics. So I've been fortunate to do a diverse number of things. I've been part of the Capitol Press Corps for 6 years. Most recently, I was deputy editor with the MERS newsletter that covers
right.
politics.
What was the most memorable story you ever covered?
The most memorable? Wow, you're putting me on the spot. You know, I have to say this last presidential primary with Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum and the whole ridiculousness about fighting over one delegate afterwards in a very close election, and having the extreme campaigning that we had and all the money spent, that was a lot of fun. We became quite the center of attention, and everybody seemed to pour into Michigan at once. So yay for our economy.
Are you severing ties with MLive then to take over the Inside Michigan Politics?
No, I'll still be a columnist for them. You know, they see it as an asset that, you know, I have a nonpartisan publication that I'm at the helm of, and that probably helps give me some more perspective to comment on politics.
What do you make of the Andy Dillon resignation?
You know, I think it's unfortunate. I got to know Andy very well when he was Speaker of the House and I was covering the legislature. And, you know, he's had a lot of personal issues since then. Hopefully he'll be able to, you know, resolve them and have some peace. But, you know, I think that it was unfortunate for him to be in such a significant position in the administration. And clearly he was distracted. So hopefully this move will be better for everybody.
It's as big a job as ever, being the treasurer of the state of Michigan. Who's in line to take over?
That is an excellent question.
Thoughts?
You know, I've been thinking about that a lot. I've heard some snarky suggestions, but I don't – like former Representative Paul Scott, but I don't see that happening. Obviously, somebody with a very strong financial background, and I wouldn't be surprised if they might look out of state, as they did with Kevin Orr as the emergency manager in Detroit.
Who can we say is number two at Treasury, though?
Well, you know, for the Treasury Department, they work hand in hand with the State Budget Office, and John Nixon heads that up. So obviously, he can fill some of the role in the meantime.
Okay. And does your pulse beat a little faster heading into a general election year? I imagine it does.
It does. I mean, there's always a lot more to cover. I mean, I just saw Rick Snyder's campaign ad over the weekend when I was watching the Lions game. So, you know, we're already in that season. So that means lots of material for me at Inside Michigan Politics.
What do you make of the Snyder-Shower matchup next year?
Well, I think it's definitely one of those races that will be watched nationally. The Washington Post consistently puts it in its top 10 races. I think it's going to be a huge spending race. And, you know, at the moment, it looks like it will be a close election. So there will be lots for us to cover.
Will there be an issue coming to the fore in the next 12 months that will end up playing a larger role in the governor's race? One that maybe we're not paying attention to now? Or do you think the issues are by and large out on the table at this point?
I think the issue is always the economy, especially when things have not improved as much as we'd all like, and you see those unemployment numbers creeping up a little bit. That's always going to be the number one issue. But the situation in Detroit, I think, is going to be a big issue as well. If that goes well, that's great for Governor Snyder. If things continue to be unstable there, I think people might be a little less sure. So I would look to see what kind of resolution we're looking at for the state's largest city.
You would say if the governor has a vulnerability, it is more likely Detroit than, say, Right to Work?
You know, I don't know that Detroit is a vulnerability. I think that that's helped him right now.
Oh, okay.
However, if Detroit continues to be the problem that most people see it as, I think it will be a knock against him. Right to Work will be an issue. Obviously, most of the workforce isn't unionized, so it might not be the biggest issue. I think jobs, obviously, since everybody wants to be employed, that's the larger issue at hand. But I do think that the fact that the economy hasn't improved as much as Governor Snyder, I think, would like it to, that's a vulnerability, because he's made a lot of promises. He's made a lot of big policy changes. But, you know, as we know in Michigan and with the national economy, the recovery has been very, very slow.
How is Mark Schauer vulnerable?
Well, Mark Schauer has taken some votes in Congress that will clearly be used against him, voting for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, voting for cap and trade, environmental policy. So, you know, clearly he's going to be painted as a liberal. He did vote for a tax increase back in 2007. He'll counter that Governor Snyder passed his own tax increases, but that muddles the issue. Mm-hmm. So I think you've seen that he's going to be cast as the typical liberal Democrat, and that will be the line of attack.
Mm-hmm. And Terry Lynn Land and Gary Peters, I'm really curious what you anticipate there.
Well, obviously, a lot of money is going to be spent when people are already raising millions of dollars apiece for this race. But in general, we tend to vote Democratic at the federal level for U.S. Senate and for the presidential election. We've voted Democratic for the last six presidential elections. You know, our two senators are Democrats. So I think there is an institutional help for Gary Peters. But if Terry Lynn Land is willing to spend a lot of her own money and raise a lot of money, which she seems to be, this will be a competitive race. This will be one that will be watched nationally.
So much is made of the split, the ideological split in the GOP. What do you make of that here in Michigan?
Well, I do think you see that playing out. There was a lot of tension up at the Republican conference on Mackinac Island, where, you know, that's more of the establishment Republicans that gather. But there are a lot of Tea Partiers that want a seat at the table. And you did see Rand Paul, who is, you know, one of the big Tea Party candidates. He ended up winning the straw poll up there, you know, even amongst people who are more – traditional Republicans. So where this fight is really taking place is at the local level. Next year, we're going to have a Republican convention where the Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor, for instance, are chosen. And whether or not those Tea Partiers are successful with their quest to be precinct delegates, which is a really arcane thing that people probably don't think of, these little local races could make a huge difference. And they could actually get Wes Nakagiri on the ticket, who is a Tea Party candidate, just because they have organized at that local level.
Are you watching the 7th Congressional District? Are you paying much attention to that here? Pam Burns, Tim Walberg?
I am. I used to cover that district quite extensively, both in Jackson and Battle Creek, so it's one of my favorites to watch. And Tim Walberg has long been a polarizing, you know, character coming out of the religious right tradition and has since kind of embraced that Tea Party mentality. Pam Burns served in the legislature in a leadership role. I think she'll make it competitive, but that district still does trend Republican, so it's going to be an uphill battle.
I want to ask you a question that I wonder about increasingly. Whenever Democrats become a majority party in the Michigan legislature again, do you think that after this period of GOP control, that they will operate any differently in pursuing their agenda?
That's, you know, when Democrats control the House in terms of just the management, it's very similar. You know, you drown out the minority, the majority rules, and you make nice little rules to help you with that bid. But Democrats as a party tend to be, in general, much more divided. You know, there is a bigger ideological spectrum. There are conservative Democrats from up north that are very pro-Second Amendment and pro-life. And then down in Detroit, there are very liberal Democrats. And so it's very hard to have cohesiveness when you represent such huge differences.
Well, Susan, we'll stay in touch. We wish you the best at the top of Inside Michigan Politics. Susan J. Demas of MLive, formerly of MERS, and soon to be the new owner of Inside Michigan Politics. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan State Spartan football team is 2-0 in conference play, 5-1 overall after Saturday's victory over Indiana. And joining us to update not just football, but a few other things as well, Al Martin, host of AM 870's Current Sports every weekday at 1, and Current Sports Television on WKAR-TV Thursday nights at 10. Good to see you, Al.
How you doing? And, you know, I want to give a shout-out to you because you came to last week's taping.
I had fun.
Thank you so much, man.
I wanted to be there from the get-go, but it took me a few weeks before I was finally able to join you. It was a good time.
Good stuff, man. Thank you for coming. I appreciate that, Mark.
What did you take from the Indiana victory here?
Well, I tell you what, looking at that game, you know, and I think everyone, you know, there were still question marks swirling for this MSU football team. You know, not only just to see if that Iowa game, which MSU looked great, they wanted to see if it wasn't a fluke. And coming into this one, early on, you talk about this Indiana offense, which, you know, looking at the stats, Indiana came into this one as with the number one ranked offense. Very high-paced offense. And early on, you look at it, they had a 17-point lead at one point. And you're sitting there like scratching your head like, okay, what's going on here? But, you know, what really stuck out to me, Mark, was that this team didn't panic. You know, they settled in and said, okay, it's time to go to work. The offense, Cook looked very comfortable and confident. After that, once that 17-point deficit came, Cook just sat back in the pocket, really did a good job of reading the defense, what the defense was giving him, and they started to roll after that. But overall, I really think MSU did a good job at a point for me, that point when they were down early on.
Keeping their cool.
They kept their cool and just rolled it on the rest of the way.
And so far this season, it would seem the evolution of this offense is the story of the season so far.
Yeah, without a doubt. A few weeks ago, you know, Mark, the big storyline who was the – we didn't have a quarterback.
Yeah.
MSU didn't have a quarterback.
Quarterback controversy to 5-1.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, and you're sitting there saying, they're struggling to put points on the board. And then these last 2 weeks, 42 points offensively. When you look at, that game, I think that MSU is really starting to come around now and starting to find themselves offensively. And you know what? A lot of that has to do with, I think, Mark – a lot of youngins stepping up here. If you look at Delvin Williams, the freshman running back here. You look at R.J. Shelton, who's a young wide receiver. You look at Langford, who went crazy this past weekend. These are guys who are relatively young compared to the rest of the team, and they're stepping up. They're stepping up in big ways. McGarrett Kings Jr., he had a muff punt, at one point during Saturday. But overall, he's been a spark plug for this team. But you're seeing a lot of guys step up and play like veterans out there these past 2 weeks. And if you look at it, the freshmen and sophomores for this team, Mark, they caught 13 of Cook's 22 passes, and that's for a total of 123 yards. That's a bulk of passes that Cook is throwing down the field to freshmen and sophomores here. So these young guys are really stepping up and making an impact that are as far exceeding anybody's expectations that we saw, coming into this season.
Now, great things were expected of the defense all along. Are they performing up to expectations, or are there any concerns there?
You know what? Early on, if anything is alarming defensively for this team, we know that MSU's defense has been great and consistently great through the years. We got a little nervous when that game first started off against Indiana on Saturday. But overall, if there's any point of concern as far as the defense is concerned, is penalties. If you look at Saturday's game, there were 10 penalties for 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
10 penalties for 100 yards. You can't – in that press conference, D'Antonio really harped on that. He was overall pleased with MSU's play. But defensively and even offensively on some occasions, you can't have 10 penalties for 100 yards as the season goes on.
In terms of the conference, our record is looking good. We're 2-0 in the conference. But by the same token, this is widely regarded as not a strong year for the Big Ten. So what does that mean for Michigan State?
It's good. Very, very, very good. Well, you know what? Because
I love that penetrating insight.
Yes, it's a very good thing. I say it so bluntly, Mark, because if MSU had any – everything that's gone on this season so far, like the beginning, didn't even have a quarterback, many question marks, is this MSU offense going to perform at any point? And they're finally starting to click. If you're going to have struggles like that to start a season, this is the season to do it because it's so wide open. Now in the Legends Division, you have a three-way tie with Michigan and Nebraska. It's so wide open, and MSU is right now still in the thick of things to really make some noise nationally. Then, of course, Michigan losing that thriller to Penn State this past weekend. It just makes everything that much interesting.
I'll tell you, the comment that really jumped out at me, though, was Drew Sharp yesterday in the Free Press commenting that a 4-2 team, most 4-2 teams are better than Michigan State, or it was words to this effect.
Right.
A lot of 4-2 teams in other conferences are a whole lot better than a 5-1 team in the Big Ten this year. Is that just the way it's playing out?
I think it is, this Big Ten is not, this conference has not been very impressive compared to other teams.
We got Ohio State way up there, and we got maybe Michigan and I think Wisconsin showed up 25th in AP this week.
Right, exactly. When you look at it, though, you compare Michigan State, nationally into, an Ohio State of some sorts.
Yeah.
Michigan State's defense is right up there. Don't get me wrong. Defensively, they can knock boots with anybody in the conference, in the nation. But when it comes to the offense – you were sitting there at the beginning of the season saying you're scratching your head. But I think MSU now, if you're a Spartan fan out there and you look at that Indiana game, you are more than pleased at what you got overall from that team. Cook, I talk about the two C's. When you talk about a quarterback who's just thrown into the mix, he's finally now being named the starting quarterback. Those first few games, those two C's are – how comfortable are you and how confident you look. Mm-hmm. And he looked very comfortable and confident as that game went on Saturday.
We're talking with WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on radio and on television. MSU would appear to have a leg up on Purdue.
Yeah.
You're expecting a win?
I am. Okay. I am. When you look at that game, I think, you know, the consistency on the defensive end, and I think right now this team is really showing that they have multiple weapons that they can throw at you. The receivers are starting to look good now. The running, I mean, if you look at the run game, Mark, you know, if you look at, you know, Indiana game, through the air, you know, the numbers were very similar. Over, you know, 200, I think only about 20 yards separated each other from, you know, Indiana's production through the air and MSU's production through the air. But on the ground, MSU totally dominated. And mm-hmm. a lot of that had to do with Langford. I mean, he had 23 rushes for 109 yards, four touchdowns, the first four-touchdown running back in MSU's, you know, backfield since, I mean, you got to go back to 2010 when Edwin Baker did it.
Okay.
I think MSU is going to do the same. I think they're going to pound him on the ground. I think MSU rolls away with that one at least by two touchdowns in that one. I think.
Let's talk a little bit of baseball
yeah,
here because
we've got the Tigers,
Tigers
right?
pursuing an American League pennant here. I cashed it in halfway through the seventh inning last night along with an awful lot of people and came to regret it here.
Yeah.
But we're back home now. So we took care of our victory on the road. Taking care
right.
of that obligation.
Right, right. Yeah, they did. I mean, you know what? I was the same way like you, Mark. I mean, I'm falling asleep halfway through the game. Next thing you know, I look up and Ortiz had smacked that, you know, that grand slam, game tying grand slam in as that game went on. I'm sitting there like, you got to be kidding me.
Do you think the Tigers will take the pennant?
I do.
Okay.
I still do. I'm still confident.
Okay.
The starting pitching has to be consistently good. I'm just worried about the relief pitching now.
Yeah.
Which looked great though in that game one. I don't, you know, Ben Wye though. You never know what you're going to get.
Back to football. Lions victory over Cleveland. What'd you make of that?
I thought that the Lions, they needed that game for a multitude of reasons. It was good to see, Megatron back in the lineup. But I think overall, I mean, the Lions are looking good, man. I thought that the production was really good for them. Defensively, it was very nice too. So
okay. And Midnight Madness is Friday night.
Yeah,
man,
Friday
there's
night.
More
yeah.
things to talk about than we've got time for. Al Martin is the host of Current Sports on WKAR AM 870, as well as WKAR TV every Thursday night at 10 o'clock. Al, thanks
a
lot.
Hey, no problem. Thanks a lot, Mark.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll have our local election coverage starting tomorrow. We'll have 4th Ward Council member from Lansing, Jessica Yorko, the incumbent, and her challenger, Chongana Canfora. Also, the Supreme Court hears arguments tomorrow in the Michigan-based case, Schutte versus the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. We'll break down both sides. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks as well to producer Kevin Lavery and Aaron Young for engineering. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.